end of the world. Maybe a socialite with long stringy pearls, but you got to serve somebody. Hey, you gotta serve somebody. Maybe the devil, maybe the Lord, but you gotta serve somebody. Rock and roll addict, prancing on the stage. Drugs that choke a man, women in the cage. Maybe a businessman, some high degree thief. May call your doctor, may call your chief. Serve somebody.
The great Etta James with Bob Dylan's You Gotta Serve Somebody. This is from her appropriately titled 2000 album, Matriarch of the Blues, and that she was. She had known trial and tribulation all of her life, but in music, she found solace, satisfaction, and comfort, and it was her gift to the world. Etta James died of leukemia on January the 20th, 2012, just 5 days shy of her 74th birthday. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. And I tell you, these days, everybody has to be on alert because literally things in Washington, especially with this president, are changing minute by minute. I had prepared my program, prepared to talk about one thing, and whoops, I just checked. And of course, Donald Trump has fired, or should I put it this way, his lawyer, one of his lawyers, a top lawyer representing him in this probe, this ongoing probe into the Russia issue, whether there was collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia. Well, he quit. John Dowd, the lead attorney in representing Trump in this matter, just said, I'm done, I'm out, and I wish you well. What does it mean when a lawyer says, I wish you well? It means that the lawyer has come to some kind of conclusion that things are not going to go too well for you. They're not going well for you now. And the ways that I'm trying to help you, you seem to know more than me and all the judges on the U.S. Supreme Court combined, all the lawyers in the world combined, and nobody could tell you anything. Nobody could advise you. So I didn't go to law school and come through that process and join a respectable law firm and plow decades of my life into making a reputation. I didn't do all of that to now reach the point where I am playing second fiddle to a second fiddle. So he said, I'm done and good luck. So it means that the Mueller investigation, and there are about 400 of these right by this time, Mueller's investigating everything. I even said to myself, and I said it on the program actually, look, it's time for some kind of indictments. Why aren't we seeing indictments? So probably there is something happening there, and we just have to wait and see. But if the Mueller investigation is having this level of impact, I can tell you there are a lot of people shaking in their boots in Washington, D.C., and a prime person among them is none other than Donald J. Trump. Oh, my goodness. It's sad. And then, of course, we have the issue of the $1.3 trillion budget, more than 2,000 pages of budget, which means nobody has read it. And they're going to be ramming this thing through without, of course, having a debate about it. This is a classic ploy. Obama did it and was able to ram through a budget in the dead of night that nobody had seen, that was more than 6 feet tall, that had all kinds of things in it that were never ever discussed. This is the kind of corruption we have become so used to. There's a budget. Okay, well, what's in it? As Nancy Pelosi once said of a budget, of the Obamacare budget, you have to vote for it first to know what's in it. I tell you, it's a very novel approach, but it has been working all these years. So why mess with something that's working, right? So the budget is going to go through, and then will come another set of fights. And that will consume a lot of time. And while the fighting is going on, the sluices are being opened. This is what is going to happen. It's a distraction. They put items in the budget that people would, of course, fight about. But the main thing is, while the legislators are fighting, they're opening up the sluices. The money is going to come out for the things that people want, that they fought to put in the budget under the radar. Hundreds of billions of dollars. You and I and other poor saps, we have no clue. We are not educated about what's in this budget and why it's in there. We have no role to play about the formulation of a budget and then the authentication of such formulation. We have no role to play. Our role is to shut up and wait for the command, which will be soon as the elections are nearing, and the command would be get out and vote. And this gives the impression that democracy is at work, because after all, people are getting out to vote. So it must be a democratic process. Not even the legislators themselves really know what's in this budget. How things end up in the budget is a behind closed doors process, and it happens at the federal level and the state level and municipal level. The people who are in control, that's the discussion we've been having. The people who are running things, the people who are in charge, the people who we dare not question, let alone oppose, these are the people who formulate a budget based on a whole bunch of criteria that have nothing to do with us. It's about who funds them, the people they report to, the people they get the marching orders from. They are the ones who actually formulate the budget. And it supposedly comes as a democratic exercise. We see people sitting down and voting. So obviously this is a democratic process. It couldn't be further from the truth. You tell me which legislator, Democrat or Republican, can raise his or her hand in public and avow, I have read every page of the more than 2,200 pages in this budget, and I know what's in it. Nobody. Nobody would be able to swear to such a thing. But that's American democracy. And we've become so used to it that it actually would be considered odd and probably illegal to have an open process where people actually debate the budget and the public hears it and the public sees it and the public is aware of the voting process. But let me remind you, as of today, when of course this measure would pass, the American people will be saddled with $1.3 trillion more in debt. So that obligates people's great-grandchildren to pay off whatever is incurred today as a cost to governing. And we have very little resistance. It's as if, well, you know, finally the Democrats and the Republicans agree on something. They agree on this budget. We have no independent source, no scientific analysis of this budget. Everybody's gone quiet. We're getting people talking about this particular concern and that particular concern, but these are parochial arguments and parochial concerns. We do not have an established coterie of economists, crackerjack economists, who can say this thing is just an absolute atrocity. We can't do this. And let us explain to the people what passing this $1.3 trillion budget actually will mean in the immediate term, but in the longer term, over generations. The people who are in charge, as we've been talking, they don't care about this because in their heads, they'll be dead soon. Certainly, they'll be dead before the real impact hits, and they'll have their money, and the money will be stashed away, and the money would be hidden, and the money would be put into things that their great-great-great-grandchildren would be benefiting from anyway. So they're not worried about this. Their thing is to get the money now. And in as much as they have the power to do so, well, gee, why not do so? Let's just come up with a fantastical scenario in which all of our needs, the needs of the power elite, are well taken care of, but we will leave the responsibility for paying the price to those people who are just so silly. They're just ordinary people. We don't need to worry about them. What could they do to us? We're running the government. We have our hand in the till. They can't do anything to us. Are they going to fire us? Are they going to put us in prison? No. We're safe. And so it is within our power and authority to relegate the burdens of our crazy decisions. The responsibility for paying the price surely will come, but not to them, not to their children, not to their grandchildren. They have generational wealth, after all. They're protected. And they have, as their way of doing business, they have a way of hiding all of this all over the world. So even if the United States were to move on them, the money is someplace else, in Peru, or it's in Japan, or someplace where it's perfectly safe. So even if they get into a little bit of trouble, well, they're laughing because we will never put our hands on all of it. And the stealing is so huge now that they could afford, they actually calculate in some cases to calculate getting busted and what it would cost. And even after calculating that, they still say, hey, I'll come out of this all right. If you bust me for a couple of million dollars, just a couple of million dollars, it's like Hillary and Bill Clinton and their wonderful foundation. If you were to bust them for a little bit of money, they laugh at you. They got millions and hundreds of millions of dollars stashed all over the place. We don't even know where. And there is no interest, really, in finding out where these people put all this money. Well, that's how we start our program today, just with these observations. But I really wanted to talk about two deaths that should bring us to a point of understanding about power in this country. And it may not even be actual power. It would be very much about perceived power, which in some cases is as good as the actual thing. If people perceive you as powerful, it is as good in some cases as being actually powerful. The power of perception is part and parcel of this concept we've been talking about for a long time called white supremacy. There was a time when power had to be actual. You actually had to be elected to office. You actually had to be a multimillionaire. But the ranks dwindled somehow, or perhaps the idea was to open up the sluices a little bit in order to build up the ranks of power. So actual power, in the sense that it was originally defined, kind of evolved. They put a bit of elastic in it. So that if you have perceived power, you don't have to have actual power, you just have to have perceived power. It's as good as having actual power. You understand? We have a lot of people who are lifted up before us as being influential and being very powerful, but they don't actually have power. They are perceived as such, or they are created to be perceived as such. For strategic reasons, it's as good as the same as the real thing. A lot of black leaders don't have the power to do anything, but they are invited to all of the very powerful conventions and they have very powerful friends. They can't get a thing done. But the system recognizes the strategy of consigning to them perceived power. And they are so delighted to have perceived power, that it doesn't dawn on them, and they're not concerned about the fact that they don't have actual power. You could think quite readily, I think, of many such individuals, Republican and Democrat, black and white, Latino, operating on these fumes of perceived power when they have no power at all or extremely limited power. And if they do have extremely limited power, it is given to them. They still don't have that. The actual power, this is the irony here, the actual power rests with the people, except the people don't seem to recognize that. They are the actual power. We saw this with the recent student movement that started to bubble up and taking on more and more credibility, and the young people are not acting like they have perceived power. They're acting like they have power because they do. They have it. And the regular arrangement between, you know, the made up kind of manufactured power and real power that was historic, that's gone. These young people are not falling for the okey-doke. They understand, and they're coming into the fullness of the understanding of real power. How you get it, how you exercise it, how you keep it. It's a marvelous lesson. Now, where am I going with this? We had in the last week, in the last several days, as a matter of fact, two tragic incidents, actually, that gives us a pointed view about real power and perceived power. And it has to do with the killing on Sunday, this past Sunday, of a 22-year-old man, father of two toddlers, Stefan Clark, in Sacramento. He was shot down, 20 bullets fired at him by two police officers who were responding, they said, to a complaint. Somebody had called into the local police station and said, there's a man who is smashing the windows of cars, probably looking for things inside them. He's 6 feet tall. He's wearing a black hoodie and a black, you know, athletic pants. And this even involved the helicopter coursing the area in order to speed up the response to this crime. And they pick up the picture of this form and they start following this person, and they follow him into a backyard, and by then police officers were on the scene, and they yelled at him, stop, stop. They never identified themselves as police. They yelled, stop, stop, and almost immediately began firing at him. They fired 20 shots. 10 apiece. He falls, and within a short time, they can tell that he's dead. Okay. That's one incident in Sacramento. I move to the other one, which is many miles away, where a 23-year-old, this is 3 days after that outrageous shooting in Sacramento, a 23-year-old man, Mark Condit, who the police are now saying he was the one who terrorized Austin, Texas for well over 17 days, and he did so by placing package bombs on people's porches, and in some cases even in plain sight, where they would be sure somebody would be picking the package up, and they open the package, it detonates. And as a result, you had two people killed, four injured, and fear permeating all of Texas, especially Austin, Texas. Is this the beginning of a race war? Is this an act of terrorism by one person? Is this a growing movement of terror? What is it? Nobody knew. Why is it being done? Nobody knew. But the bomber, Condit, made a fatal mistake in that they were able to piece together certain things to get to his identity. He bought his bomb parts at a local Home Depot, and he even visited, although he wore a blonde wig under his cap, he visited a FedEx, a local FedEx, and he had two parcels to mail. And they determined, of course, that there were bombs in them. The people who were killed, by the way, were people of color. African Americans, and one Latina was very badly wounded when she attempted to open this package that came to her home. Okay then, so we have a bomber, right? And bombers are not respected people. Bombers, however, are admired people in a way. Because they're smart. At least this is the going theory among law enforcement in the United States. We don't hear very much about how stupid a bomber is. They're smart people. They may be wacky, but they're smart. And they almost always are white and male. We go back to Sacramento. This young man that the police were following, one person, they were following by helicopter and on the ground by several units, happened to be an African American man. And it wasn't like he was a bomber. The great crime that the report or the complaint that came in said was somebody was smashing windows of a car, of cars parked in the area, and apparently removing things from them. So you know right away, this person has already been plugged into the psyche of law enforcement. He does not get special treatment, not in a good way. He belongs to the powerless group. And therefore, the mentality locks in automatically as to how this person is to be dealt with. He's wearing what? A hoodie, according to the caller who called in this complaint to the police. He's wearing a hoodie. He is in a middle class, well, a working class community. But he's wearing a hoodie. And he's mashing or smashing windows with an object. Okay, right off the bat, the police are empowered to dispense with any kind of procedures that they would normally follow. because they know who they're dealing with. He isn't entitled to special, quote, special police ways of doing things. He's just a powerless guy. And when has it been the case that you have heard, or doesn't it strike you as odd, that a call, I mean, all crime is really detestable, but this is a crime of property, if anything. Somebody is said to be just mashing up the windows of cars and taking things. Now, they're just that's just it. The police, therefore, the first glimpse they have of this man from the air is that this is him. He's got to be the one. When was the last time you heard of a helicopter involved in what is essentially a case? It's not a big crime in the scheme of things, but a helicopter is involved, and they're using heat-seeking methods of trying to locate him. And when other officers on the ground are guided toward him, procedures go out the window. The cops don't even have to identify themselves. They don't have to find out who he is, where he was. Is he possibly the guy? Is he the same one that they just received a report about, a guy smashing people's windows, car windows, and he ducks into an alley somewhere. He ducks into a backyard somewhere. He also comes from the backyard. And when the cops meet up with him, the backyard that he's in is his grandmother's backyard. And that's where everybody makes contact, because the front doorbell doesn't ring. It doesn't work. And everybody knows that this particular house, if you want to get the attention of the people inside, you got to knock on the back door. They chase this man. Again, no declaration by police as to who they are and why they are detaining him, or why they want him. And almost instantaneously, if you look at the tape, it's like just a matter of seconds between their order to stop. You can't see who is saying stop. It's dark. And the bullets start flying. It was said that he had an object in his hand, possibly the same object that was used to smash the windows. Well, turns out it was a phone, a cell phone. But he's dead. And he's dead because he belongs to the group of the powerless. And there is an understanding of how you deal with people who belong to that group. Nothing special. Now, never mind the fact that the Sacramento Police Department had been through the ringer around this issue of how the police treat locals. They've gone through it. The community erupted. And we had all these promises from the new mayor, the new police commissioner. Things would be different. All this training. By the way, one of the things they trained them for was the use of body cameras, except with the killing of Clark, you're hearing somebody say, this is after he's down on the ground dead. He's in fact at his grandmother's door when he's killed. You're hearing things like mute the microphones, essentially. So they have body cameras, but they muted them. The expectation was that if they manipulate this well enough, they could get by. It was, after all, a dark night, but all of the regular police procedures were out the window. Why? He belongs to the powerless class. So there's no need to really exercise restraint and to follow rules. On the other hand, with our bomber, Mark Condit, you have the epitome of restraint. Although they're very much on his heels, and they want to capture him, and they're working very fast, and they're trying to put things together, there is no breach of procedure. Although he's a bomber, although he is a killer, he admitted so in a videotape he made before he blew himself up in his car. He authenticated every charge they had against him. And still, very, very circumspect about making sure they did not move beyond. They did not do anything untoward, even in pursuit of a killer. He's a young man, but he's a white young man. And he comes from a good family, as if that has anything to do with it. He comes from a good Christian family. And they were appalled to know what he had done, because it is so dark, as they said. They did not know him to have these thoughts in his head. And so the sympathy of the system went also to the family, because they see the whole thing, the community, the family, the individual, as part of a system to be viewed as having power. You don't mess around. You have to be very careful. In the other case, you can do what you want. And they did. So now people are back in Sacramento wondering, what then does it mean that the police who promised to do right, to not just shoot and kill black men especially, because they accounted for the largest number of shootings by police. It's because they don't understand how the police really do see us and see them. You are dispensable. You have no power. You have no power that counts. We can come into your neighborhood in the most dramatic way with a helicopter and with the heat sensing devices, and we can hunt you down even in your own backyard with your grandmother on the other side of the door, and we can kill you in a barrage of 20 bullets, and we can still stand proud and say, at the time that this was happening, although they regret the tragedy, in other words, bear with us. If you were in our position, it might have happened to you too. On the other side,
you have a killer. He is a killer. A bomb maker. A terrorist. And a madman whose intention was to continue. If he hadn't been caught, he would have continued. And as an individual, in his head, he had as much power and authority as the entire country to do as he wished. You see, very often crimes start with the psyche. One man living in a world in which he is to assume he's a target. He is to assume that the police can do anything they want because they have. And they've gotten away with it. The system exercises its power, its discretionary power, in their behalf. On the other side of the coin, a white man who clearly has some mental issues, we wouldn't argue with that, but he's a killer just the same. And he killed people of color in particular. And he held the entire city hostage and in fear what is going to happen. But instead, the power structure has already situated itself in a very understanding kind of way and sympathetic too. Obviously, he came from a good home. So why didn't it take? He's a Christian. He himself says he has no idea what his political philosophy was, despite the fact that he branded himself a conservative. He doesn't know what the heck he's talking about. But that doesn't matter. He had in his head the authority to dispatch people arbitrarily from life because he felt like it. And he didn't exercise this authority in his white neighborhood. So he must have had some kind of feeling about that. And the cops were on to him. But everything was handled, I would say, with great proficiency. And the way you would say professionals ought to do what they do. They didn't kill him. They were coming to arrest him. He killed himself. By his own authority, he died by his own hand. And I can't help but believe that somewhere in this messed up mind of his, he had the clarity to understand what he can do and what he cannot do or would not do or should not do. What he was allowed to do, he did. Well, the last part didn't work out, but even that he calculated ahead, that he was going to do what he did, and he was not going to pay for it. He was not going to allow the system to make him pay for it. He did it himself. So, when we talk as we do about community action and how people are configuring things and understanding systems. He made his own system. Mark Condit of Austin, Texas. He made his own system. He was operating on his own system. It's the people in Austin, Texas refuse to recognize the reality. There were people in Austin, Texas, black people, Latinos, who dismissed from their minds entirely the possibility that they could be targeted this way. They were, after all, living in decent housing. They had, their children had, some of their best friends were whites. They were living decently. They had decent jobs that afforded them a decent way of life. That ugly part, with people hunting them down or selecting them for annihilation, just was not part of their world or consciousness anymore. It couldn't happen to them. But they didn't count on the fact that there are people who resent it, that you're doing better than they are. Your children are doing better than their children. You having a life you were never supposed to have. And that's what's wrong with America. America has lost sight of this business of who deserves and who does not deserve. So I'm going to settle scores. I'm going to set things right. Since the authorities won't do it, or they don't have the guts to do it, but I know they want to do it if they could, so I'll do it for them. I will show you what power looks like. So, in the black world, there's the familiar, we've talked about it here, I've talked about it here quite a bit. The bone collectors are still collecting bones. Their sense of power derives from somebody's dead body. And how they are going to interpose themselves between the community and the system and broker a peace, broker an understanding, broker a solution that enhances their power. It's election time, and they will now use this as a way to even increase their power, they think. People will come to me to ask me to chill the folks out. And I could demand a handsome amount of money to do just that. But we should be thinking about these kinds of crimes and these scenarios in a very different way. Having to do not even with real power, but perceived power. Do you belong to a group perceived as powerful? You don't even have to be actually powerful now. Just perceived as powerful. Will you be a target? Is this system now evolving to include direct confrontations with people of perceived power? We know we don't have it, but they perceive that we do. So I'll leave that for us to ponder, and we'll talk a bit some more tomorrow on Free Your Mind Friday about these and other relevant issues. But I wanted to bring that to your attention. And we see things, they're not at all disconnected, because when you're dealing with systems, there's no boundary line, there's no geography. It's a universal concept, and you have to react to it as such. Thanks for listening today. I hope I made some kind of sense to you. And as I said, tomorrow is Free Your Mind Friday, so we'll pick up from where we left off today. And I want you to stay tuned, because Expanding Mind with Eric Davis is up next. We'll see each other tomorrow. Bye-bye. Call your doctor, may call your chief. You got to serve somebody. Oh, serve somebody. Might be the devil all along, but you gotta serve somebody. Maybe a state trooper, maybe a young Turk. Maybe the head of some big